While they're passing the handouts, I want to do a disclaimer, a general introduction to my subject. Some of you were here when I taught on the life of Arthur Pink. And what's interesting about A.W. Pink is you could read almost everything he wrote, and it doesn't have to be in the historic context of his own life, because there's just nothing biographical, for the most part, in any of A.W. Pink's writings. Well, when I first discovered the writings of Robert Dabney, that was pretty much true as I started out. I had his Systematic Theology. And there's a number of books called The Discussions of Dabney, and I think for the most part it's articles that were in the Southern Presbyterian Review. At the time that Thomas Carey Johnson wrote his biography of Dabney, there were four of these. I know now there's five, because the fifth one right now is for sale on Amazon.com. So when I'm referring to Dabney's discussion, I'm referring to these five volumes. Some of them contain sermons. For example, when he went to New York at one time, he preached a sermon that you have a quote from, "The world white unto harvest reaper it perishes." Those are in his book on discussions. As far as his biographies, the original one of some length was by Thomas Carey Johnson, who also wrote A Life of Benjamin Morgan Palmer. Johnson was the successor to Dabney, but not his immediate successor, but had the most materials to put a biography together. And this thing is really full. Dabney was a prolific letter writer. There's so much in this material. But in more recent days, there's a new biographical series that started by the Presbyterian Reform Publishing, and this was the first of it, and this is by Sean Michael Lucas, who teaches at Covenant Theological Seminary, and it's got mixed reviews. I've read every single review that there is about this book on the Internet, but to some people, they don't like this book, as it reminds me of the words of Lynyrd Skynyrd, "A Southern man don't need him around anyhow." But the thing about it is, Dabney was a philosopher. He had an incredible mind. And you almost need somebody with Lucas's abilities, he has a doctorate in philosophy, to be able to look through all of his writings and see where he was going and where his strengths and weaknesses were. So for me, this was indispensable. I couldn't hardly do this study without referring to Lucas. And the only other disclaimer that I would add this morning is that a dear Christian brother told me to be very careful not to get into the politics of the Civil War. And I can see the wisdom of that, but I have to be somewhat tempered. That's like asking me to do the life of Martin Luther without mentioning the Roman Catholic Church. However, if you see Matt Potter running out of here and he goes home and crawls into his bed in the fetal position and turns the electric blanket up to 9, I'll take that as a sign that I'm probably getting off track. Now, I've always been interested in what men look like. If you ever looked at my website, thereformedpastor.net, I have a collection of these pictures, and somebody may be asking, what's with the long white hair and the white beard? And I thought about that too, and I've determined that it's a sign of orthodoxy. Because if you look at the men in that day, you got D.H. Carroll, who founded Southwestern Seminary, J.C. Ryle, whose name speaks for itself, and J.G. Patton, the missionary to the New Hebrides. Well, my theory is not watertight, because I also saw a picture this week of Charles Darwin, and so I have to work on that theory some. So in a commencement address delivered at the Hampton-Sydney College in 1882, a 60-year-old, 2-year-old Warren Saint Robert Dabney said, this is in a sermon called The New South, which is in volume 4 of his collected works, discussions, "The heritage of freedom which our fathers left us, we have been unable to entrust to you. Our apology is that in the endeavor to set the liberties transmitted by our fathers, we did what we could. And in proof of this justifying plea, we can point to the forms prematurely bent and the heads withered with fatigue and camp diseases, to the empty sleeves and wooden legs, and to the Confederate graves so thickly strewn over the land. Our apology is, again, that while we were contending for the rights and interests of the civilized world, nearly the whole world blindly and passionately arrayed itself against us. When Dabney had finished his speech, it is said a large part of the audience was in tears. One after another of the grave trustees, that's Union Seminary, came and took his hand and wrung it while the tears were running down their cheeks. Some sobbed aloud, unable to control their feelings. But by that time, 1882, the sentiment of the estimate of Robert Dabney was very mixed. In fact, he had to have that commencement address approved by the president of the seminary. But what was it that Dabney was fighting for, and what can we learn from what is often called his prophetic insight of the evils that he saw coming on our nation? Stephen Berry, who is one of the people who reviewed this biography, told a story that in 1902 there was a Samuel Mills who was in a secondhand bookshop in Houston, Texas, as many Presbyterian pastors and some Reformed Baptists are wont to do, and he saw a stack of papers in one corner that drew his attention. Upon inquiry, he learned that these manuscripts were destined for destruction. The owner was comforted that the curious parson desired to relieve him of the trouble of disposal. So there you have this pile of papers, and this pastor wants these papers, and the bookstore owner says, I'm glad he's going to throw them out for me. So the pastor blew the dust off and tied the packet of papers into a large armful and triumphantly carried his prize home. In a study of his manse, he made a startling discovery. The aging papers belonged to the Southern Presbyterian theologian Robert Louis Dabney. This revelation troubled Tinney, who thought, is this the way our church treats her great men? Then Stephen Berry refers to Dabney as rescued from the trash bins of history. Well, why would he say something like that? Basically, from 1898, the year that Dabney died, until 1960, his name was pretty much sunk in oblivion. It wasn't until the Banner of Truth republished his discussions and his systematic theology that he was much even heard from. But other estimates of Dabney aren't so kind. Again, he states, those who continue to champion Dabney as a great theologian and prophet downplay the reality of slavery as practiced in the 19th century South and the harm that bondage wrought on African Americans. By the way, they use that term African Americans. I think that's anachronistic when you're applying to Dabney's time, because the very problem was they weren't treated as Americans. The 15th Amendment wasn't passed till 1870, which gave them the right to vote. But they bring Dabney's cultural context under the protective umbrella of the church. Now, other evangelicals seek to distance themselves completely from troubling figures like Dabney, purging him from the pantheon of heroes of the faith. They push Dabney out of the church, placing him fully in his alien culture. But I've saw it in the study of Dabney, not to minimize his faults, but to bring you to an awareness of his writings, and saw how some of his foresight and warnings of the evil that he saw coming on the horizon are being played out in the news events of even our own day. Just some of the subjects that Dabney wrote on in the discussions, you can find his principles of Christian economy, our secular prosperity, civil ethics, geology and the Bible, secular education, the legal profession, civil government, and much more. There's a really interesting article in there on labor unions. That was written later in his life, but Dabney was no fan of them. I think it would take me off track, though, to discuss that. So Thomas Carey Johnson, who wrote the original life of Dabney, says that there were three great men of the South in those days, Thornwell, B.M. Palmer, and Dabney. Well, Dabney was born in 1820, and his name is probably derived from Daubigny's, from the French Huguenots, from the same Daubigny who wrote the history of the Reformation. His father was Charles Dabney, a prominent lawyer of Louisa County, Virginia, who died when Robert was only 13 years old. If you'll remember when I was talking about the life of Asahel Nettleton, his father had died at a very young age as well. And so the son had to shoulder a burden of a family. There were six children, and he was a tremendous help. Young Robert attended what was called an open field school, of which the boy wrote to his mother that there were good teachers and plenty of birch. Like Robert Breckinridge once declared, he was raised on the shorter catechism and the switch. In 1836, young Dabney entered Hampton Sidney College, where he made the highest mark in his classes. It was while he was at Hampton Sidney that Robert Dabney was converted at 17 years of age. In 1839, he entered the University of Virginia and graduated as Master of Arts in 1842. He taught school and managed his mother's farm. So Dabney went away for a while to college for a couple of years, but the burden of his family back home, I believe his mother was about to lose the farm, he came back and worked very diligently. He was a very hard worker, and he was a very brilliant man. You know, he did architectural type drafting, and so he was earning money in the meantime to continue his college education, and he had been able to come up with about $300. So he decided to study for the ministry, and he was introduced to the faculty of Union Seminary, then at Hampton Sidney, by a letter from William Plumer. Well, Dabney had really early on shown some skills as a writer, and I believe that he was submitting articles to the Richmond Inquirer, and one of them was in defense of theological institutions of education, such as Union Seminary, which got the attention of some of the faculty there. And when they lost one of their professors, they only had three, they started pressing Dabney to come on as a professor at the seminary, which he was always backward. He was loath to think that he was capable of such a thing, but he's out there working on the farm, and his wife comes out with a letter and says they've chosen a new professor at Union Seminary. And he said, well, who would that be? She said, it's you. So he went in and read the letter, and there was a good deal of pleading about how they thought that his strength would add to the seminary. At the same time, he was licensed to preach in May of 1846, and he pastored Providence Church in Louisa near his mother's home. So that's the original college that Robert Dabney went to, Hampton Sidney College. And that's the old picture of Union Theological Seminary. He was destined by his writings to bring the philosophical and theological world into debt to God for him, says Thomas Carey Johnson. He and his devoted wife Lavinia had six sons, only three who lived to maturity. In the year 1860, he was called to two different places. He was continually asked, at least on three occasions, by Charles Hodge to help out at Princeton Seminary. And he was also called to the Fifth Avenue Presbyterian Church in New York City. Those two places had something in common. They both called Dabney because in the case of one, James Waddell Alexander died, who was a pastor of the Fifth Presbyterian Church. In the case of Princeton, Joseph Addison Alexander died, who was James' brother and the son of Archibald Alexander. These were the sons of Archibald Alexander, the founder of Princeton, which was started in 1812. Well, to give you an idea of what an estimate that was of Dabney's abilities, Joseph Addison Alexander, who taught it New Testament at Princeton, and I hope to bring this out if I do a study of Machen, was a brilliant man who himself knew 26 languages. So these are pretty big shoes to fill, but he never left Virginia. I want to tell you a little story about this church, though. That's why I have a picture of it. Some of you know I used to live in New York City, and I'd have Saturdays off. I was stationed there in the Coast Guard, so I would get on the ferry and ride into Manhattan, and you get off at South Ferry, and then I'd take a subway train down to Times Square and 42nd Street. From there, I would walk down to Central Park, and then I started walking 6 miles back to South Ferry. But I was always interested in the church architecture of New York City, and I saw this church off at a distance, so I said, I'm going to go check it out. And I tried the door, and it was open, so I walked in, and the man came and greeted me. He may have been the pastor. I was under awakening in those days, and my conscience was pretty tender, so I engaged in a conversation with him very quickly, and I discovered that he was a complete theological liberal. And I said to him, I don't know how in the world you can do any warfare with the devil if you don't believe that the scriptures are the word of God. And that was easy enough. He didn't believe in the devil. So at that time, I knew it was time to leave. Anyway, there's something in Dabney's biography that's always interested me that a lot of people don't bring out when they tell the story of him that really captured my attention when he was a young pastor, and that is the death of his two sons. He actually lost three, but this is so gripping that two sons died of diphtheria within 2 weeks of each other. And this letter to his brother is so remarkable. It says, my dear brother, your letter was received yesterday and found us in great sorrow. If you had known at the time the sorrowful circumstances in which it would find us, last Monday, a little after 12 o'clock, our little Jimmy was taken from us by that fearful enemy of the young, putrid sore throat. Just 2 weeks before, Bobby had been taken, at first not very violently, but afterwards he was for 2 days and nights at death's door. When he was taken, I was about to start to the Senate of North Carolina at Greensboro, about 140 miles off. I hesitated a good deal about starting, but Lavinia thought I might venture. From the time I left, Bobby grew rapidly worse, and Sunday evening I got a letter and telegram telling me that he was extremely ill. His attack had developed itself as a putrid sore throat and threatened suffocation. I started that night, traveled all night, and reached home the next night about 8 p.m. Bobby was greatly relieved, but exceedingly feeble, having had a terrific attack. Now he is feeble and threatened with a rising on the neck. The rest seemed well, but the next evening, last Tuesday week, we discovered that Jimmy was chilly and feverish and in short had the sore throat. We used prompt measures and sent early for the doctor, who did not think his case dangerous, but he grew gradually worse until Sunday, when his symptoms became alarming and he passed away after great sufferings Monday. He was intelligent to the last, even after he became speechless, and his appealing looks to us and the physician would have melted a stone. Some half hour before he died, he sank into a sleep which became more and more quiet until he gently sighed his soul away. This, my dear brother, is the first death we have had in our family and my first experience of any great sorrow. I have learned rapidly in the school of anguish this week and am many years older than I was a few days ago. It is not so much that I could not give my darling up so far as self was concerned, but that I saw him suffer such pangs and then fall under the grasp of the cruel destroyer while I was impotent for his help. Ah, when the mighty wings of the angel of death nestles over your heart's treasures and his black noisome shadow broods over your home, it shakes a heart with a shuddering terror and a horror of great darkness. To see my dear little one thus ravaged, crushed, and destroyed, turning his beautiful liquid eyes to me and his weeping mother for help after his gentle voice was obstructed, and to feel myself as helpless is he to give any aid, this tears my heart with anguish. And then I remember that this death reigns over all else that I love, over wife, remaining children, friends, and my own body, and may seize them, I know not when. How fearful is it to live and love in such a world? I'm going to discuss really quickly Dabney as a theologian, because as Douglas Kelly says in this book, this is Southern Reformed Theology, he says it's in the common Reformed idiom and speaks for itself. So I would only say that he wasn't a speculative theologian like a Jonathan Edwards. Well, what's a speculative theologian? My definition is a theologian going in where angels fear to tread. And he didn't speculate. He stuck strictly to the Westminster Confession, and it was striking that Union Seminary was very much like Princeton. They used Francis Turretin in Latin and the theology of the Scottish theologian John Dick. But even on speculative things such as superlapsarian and infralapsarian, sublapsarian, and so on, you've heard the arguments. Immediate imputation, Dabney wouldn't even go there. He says, in my opinion, this is a question which never ought to have been raised. Both schemes are illogical and contradictory to the true state of facts. God's decree has no succession, and to him no successive order of parts, because it is a contemporaneous unit. I like the way they phrase these things. Comprehended altogether by infinite intuition. His intuition is infinite. It isn't in a chronological order. In this thing, the statements of both parties are untrue to God's thought. Well, a later estimate of by John Murray said that Dabney's strengths was in the doctrine of man. I'm going to tell you a story really quickly for those who took the Doctrine of God class by Greg Nichols. I know that Pastor Sesema did, and I believe Earl Shetler, but Nichols has this chapter in there called The Emotivity of God. Does God have emotions? You know, how do you deal with that? The Bible says, the confession said, God without passions, but what about his emotivity? And Nichols had written great length about that. That's in chapter 9 of the works, Doctrine of God. And I was with the Nichols at Thanksgiving one time, and somehow we got on this discussion. I don't even remember how it was, about the emotivity of God. And I said, you know, Pastor Nichols, if you would read Dabney's discussions on God's indiscriminate proposals of mercy, much of your homework's already been done for you. And so Nichols was surprised at that. So Pastor Nichols went into his library and he grabbed this book. And I can still see this picture. He's got Dabney's discussions in one hand, and he's playing a game of Scrabble with some other people on the other. He's reading and he's playing Scrabble. And I looked at him and I said, I don't know how you do that. Because Dabney's the type of theologian I have to read and then I have to reread it again to be able to grasp the arguments. Anyway, during this time, about 1860, the clouds of the Civil War were on the horizon. And Dabney wrote on April 20th, 1861, as he foresaw the approaching evils of what he called mountainous aggregate of enormous crime, of ruined constitution, of cities sacked, of reeking battlefields, of scattered churches, of widowed wives and orphan children, of souls plunged into hell. He was talking about what happened during the Civil War. When the dark cloud of war settled over our land, Dr. Dabney exerted himself to allay excitement and preserve peace in the Union. His trenchant articles written at that time met with warm commendation in the North as well as in the South. Dabney wasn't a partisan at first. He didn't want to see the country go to war. In fact, when it came to the issue of slavery, the Latin term they use is, this is not casus belli. When you talk about the Civil War, you'll hear the term antebellum and postbellum. Ante means beforehand, and bellum means war. And in Latin, casus belli means cause for war. The slavery issue, the abolitionist issue, wasn't something that he felt we should go to war over. It was when Lincoln proceeded to usurp power to coerce sovereign states, Dabney at once ceased to be a Union man. Resistance to usurpation became then a sacred duty. The South had a good and righteous cause. So he served for 5 months as the chief of staff to General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. A long, terrible spell of camp fever set in, which brought him near to death's door. The chief surgeon, Walton, pronounced that he would never be fit for service and would die if he should go back. He was forced to resign, and Jackson approved it only with great reluctance. General Jackson told Samuel Morrison that he considered Dabney the most efficient officer he knew, that he was very, very much pleased with him as an adjutant and knew no one that could fill his place, which is interesting because Lucas believes that Dabney's getting out so early affected his own self-esteem of his manhood. And I thought to myself, well, here you are, a seminary professor in Covenant Theological Seminary. Suppose that you're called to go to Iraq for 5 months, and because of sickness, you then resign and have to come home. In my estimate, that would make somebody a man that went to the Civil War for 5 months. So I think that's a little bit derogatory, but he was forced to resign shortly after his resignation. While himself lying sick in relapse, he lost a third son to diphtheria, Thomas Price Dabney, November 8th, 1862. So now there's 3 sons that have died of diphtheria. While lying at home, crippled by ill health and having little teaching to do, he conceived the plan of fighting for the Confederacy with a pen. If I can't fight the North with a sword, I'll fight for the Confederacy with my pen. His object was to rebut the slanders of the Yankees against our institutions. He believed that moral support was as necessary to the Confederacy as military support. He wrote a defense of Virginia and the South during this time. It was sent successfully through the Yankee blockades and was to be published in Europe with the hope that it would stir up some Southern sympathies. So let's talk about this book. As much as I would like to avoid it, this isn't going to be any kind of a Bible study about slavery, because I don't have the time. But I want to critique this book because Dabney's aim is to demonstrate that slavery per se was not a sinful economic and social relationship. But does he prove his arguments from Scripture? That's my examination, and I'm just going to say right out front that he doesn't. And I'm thankful enough, 25 years as a Reformed Baptist, I don't have to ask around to a lot of Reformed Baptists and say, do you think that the Bible defends slavery from the Scriptures? Because to a person, I'm almost certain that they would say no. So Dabney's claim one, Virginia was not involved in the slave trade. Slaves were traded in England and New England. But Virginia profited economically from the slave trade, transporting slaves through Richmond and Alexandria. I was doing some research on this, and this has been well documented. You hear this phrase, no slaves were ever brought to America on a ship sailing the Confederate flag. And I guess I don't understand that argument. They still came into the ports of Virginia, and they were still purchased up until 1808. But I must make a distinction. Dabney never, never argued for the slave trade. He saw it as an abomination. All he's trying to answer is the question, is someone being a slave under bondage, because he defines his terms, is that a proper social and economic relationship that could be defended by the Bible? Claim two, the Bible teaches that the relationship of master and slave is perfectly lawful and right, provided only its duties be lawfully fulfilled. His biblical argument is Genesis 9. And if you remember, that's when God had sanctioned slavery according to him. I'm using the word sanction according to him and his posterity. So slavery could not be sinful. Dabney also considered Abraham and Isaac as slaveholders, and God did not disapprove of this evidence by the sacrament of circumcision being extended to them. I wanted to do a study of just the verses in Genesis 9, and I came across this comment at the Institution of Creation Research, which I haven't been able to find out who wrote that commentary, but I know that Henry Morris has a commentary on Genesis, and my assumption was these are his words. The phrase servant of servants is never used elsewhere in Scripture. If it means slave of slaves, then the prophecy has failed, for neither the Hamitic nations in general nor the Canaanite nations in particular have ever been such. The Hamites have included such great empires as Sumeria, Phoenicia, Egypt, Ethiopia, and so on, and quite possibly the great Asian nations, China, Japan as well. The word servant, however, is more often used in the sense of steward, so the prophecy more likely speaks of Ham's descendants as superlative stewards. That is, all men were stewards of God's created world in the sense of exercising dominion over its resources, and Ham, with his physical and materialistic bent, would be especially effective in subduing the world and developing its resources. Since the ground had been cursed, however, this meant Ham's lot would be uniquely associated with the physical world, thus itself becoming a curse. Noah's statement, it should be remembered, was a prophecy and not an imprecation given under divine inspiration and on the basis of Noah's own insight into the developing characters of his sons and grandsons and therefore of their descendants. As a prophecy, this interpretation is fitting, since the Hamitic nations have indeed been the great explorers, cultivators, builders, navigators, tradesmen, inventors, and warriors of mankind. But Dabney goes on to argue slavery is mentioned twice in the Ten Commandments, the fourth allowing slaves to rest in worship, and the tenth not to covet your neighbor's slaves. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, I'm not sure that I want to argue whether slavery is sanctioned by God because it's regulated by God. Remember, God also regulated polygamy and divorce, but they were not, we don't want to conclude from that, that they are divine institutions. As God at first made only one wife for a man and no slaves, so it was his intention that he should have only wife and no, one wife and no slaves. Dabney claimed that God himself was a slaveholder in Numbers 31:25-30 and Joshua 9:20-27. We have instances which are, if possible, still stronger. In the former passage, the people of Midian who had been conquered by God's command, and so on. Now, Sean Lucas himself, who examines the book, A Defense of Virginia in the South, doesn't even comment on this because he thought it's incredible that Dabney would even make an argument like this. But then he goes on to his New Testament proofs. Our Lord has thrown at least a probable light upon the estimation of slaveholders by his treatment of the centurion of Capernaum and his slave. In Colossians 3:22 and 4:1, 1 Timothy 4:1-2, slaveholders were prominent members of the early church. But Dabney conveniently ignores or explains away several passages that mitigate against slavery. Deuteronomy 23:15 commands Israelites not to return slaves who had run away from oppressive foreign masters. Instead, they should be allowed to live among the Israelites as freedmen under their protection. But if one granted that slaves in the Confederate states were not foreign, but similar to Hebrew slaves, these slaves should have been subject to the biblical law of Jubilee. In Leviticus 25:8-55, it describes a 50th or Jubilee year. Jubilee means liberty. God owns the land, and in the Jubilee, he wants the return of every man to his possession. The land must be redeemed. Men must be returned to their land, their family. When Dabney discusses the Jubilee, he focused on the fact that foreign slaves were not liberated. So this is a contradiction. Either the African slaves are foreign, or they are akin to Hebrew slaves. They cannot be both. And then he does what Lucas calls hermeneutical gymnastics with 1 Corinthians 7:20 and 21. Art thou loose from a wife? Seek not to be bound. You know, are you a slave? Seek to be free. And then he says we must remember the circumstances of the age in order to do justice to his meaning. He doesn't say seek to be free. He says if you are made free, it is to your benefit. It's also stated that the slaves Paul mentioned were of the same skin color, but the African slave would be, being a black, find himself only deprived of his master's patronage and still debarred as much as ever from social equality. Now, that's an interesting argument. We don't want to free him because by being black, he's going to be ostracized. There's a couple of problems with that. The Bible in the New Testament, for example, in Galatians 3:28, is talking about the building of the New Testament church, where there is neither Jew or Greek, there is neither slave nor free, Galatians 3:28. But in Revelation 5:9, which we should remember an exposition of not long ago, the redeemed people of God sung a new song, saying, Thou art worthy to take the book and to open the seals thereof, for thou wast slain and hast redeemed us to God by thy blood out of every kindred and tongue and people and nation. But there's another contradiction because during his defense of Virginia in the South, he talks about how the slaves are treated. It seems to contradict two letters he wrote earlier in his life to his brother. I've read both of those this week, and years before, Dabney had freely admitted the great problem that existed between white male masters and black female slaves, yet when he wrote his book, Defense, he claimed that the crime of white men violating the chastity of black female slaves was unheard of in the part of white men amongst us. But I was focusing on those words, and I had read enough of Dabney to know of a comment that he makes in his book. One of the last books he ever wrote was called The Practical Philosophy. And in it, he's talking about the grounds of divorce, and he says the grounds of divorce are only for adultery and for desertion. But he says, well, what about the woman who has been beaten? And he says that is grounds for separation and she should be able to possibly receive alimony. But his argument is if she has been beaten, the chances are very certain that he's probably been unfaithful to her as well. And I thought, well, how would Dabney know that? Unless he knows, because he is a good theologian. I've read his commentary on, he's a good Bible commentator on 1 Corinthians 3:11-15 about building upon the foundation. I've read his comments about Charles Hodges' systematic theology and the imputation of Adam's sin, Romans 5:11-21. And I know he's a good exegete, so I don't understand why he's making these comments. I know that Dabney knew that sins against the sixth commandment and sins against the seventh commandment were very closely tied together. So, of all of Dabney's books, my conclusion is this is the one that I wish had never have been written. But to go on, Doug Kelly says, after the bitter defeat of the South in 1865, and then the agony of Reconstruction, much of Dabney's life seemed to be lived under deepening shadows. But in his defense, someone says, let's get to the heart of the issue. Dabney's rhetoric, because there was a lot of rhetoric in his polemical writings, not in his systematic theology. He avoided any stringent tones, any rhetoric as a theologian. But on writing of some of these other issues, there is a good deal of stridency and rhetoric, but it can only be understood in the context of Reconstruction. If one does not understand the nightmare of Reconstruction, this person says, drive through Natchez, Mississippi today, then one cannot understand Dabney's fight. Dabney saw that Reconstruction was the overturning of constitutionalism and the rule of law in the land. Dabney could not just forgive and forget a people who raped his homeland, destroyed the finest of a civilization, and in many cases attacked the Christian faith. To the Southern theologian, the abolitionist movement wasn't just a movement to free the slaves. That was the political reason given, but there was a great deal of atheism, Unitarianism, and so on that was behind it. The South, for the most part, when the Presbyterian Church split in 1837, the solid school was the old school Presbyterians, and they were represented by Princeton Seminary in the north, but most of the seminaries in the south. So Dabney's going through this time of depression, and he even considered moving to Brazil during this day, but he decided to stay. But for the rest of his life, he was at war with his age. And a lot of that war came out in his writings. And while he was at Union Seminary, he wrote some of his great philosophical writings, Essentialistic Philosophy, which really deals with the idea that the humanist holds to, that we cannot know anything. There's no such thing as intuition. The only thing that we know is through our senses. And Dabney combated that. There was the 18th century secularist enlightenment and the 19th century European developments that were bringing vast changes to the Western world, and it seems the war between the states hastened the breakdown of the relative isolation and conservative Christian consensus of the American South. Then also you had going on, remember in those days, you had the influence of Charles Darwin, and you had the evangelism of Dwight Moody and Charles Finney, and Dabney locked horns with both of these systems. See, a lot of people, they look at Dabney's rhetoric and they say he was a bitter man. He's bitter because his team lost in the South. But there was so much more than that. I'm not excusing his bitterness. You cannot interpret Dabney without seeing him in the context of the things that were going on in the United States. The evolutionary theory and this type of evangelism, and Dabney wrote continually against it. He saw the problem. And as I've studied Dabney, I would say that his mind in being able to understand spurious religious excitements, a title that he has of one of his discussions in Volume 3, he had a mind that was almost, to me, as great as Jonathan Edwards in being able to ascertain these things. And he saw where Dabney is often mentioned as prophetic, but prophetic in the logical conclusions. Even 30 years before seminaries and so on, he saw where that would lead, and he combated it very early on. So there was a problem of a new type of evangelism with their new methodologies. And it wasn't Dabney's stringent tone and inflexibility and lack of tact that were alienating others from him, but his uncompromising stand on biblical Calvinism that was becoming an embarrassment to the post-Enlightenment and broadening evangelical mainstream. And this thing kept coming to a head and coming to a head, and finally, just a year after he did his commencement address in 1882 on the New South, he was pretty much pushed out of Union Seminary. And with much sadness and frustration with what was going on at Union Seminary, he accepted a call to teach at the University of Texas in Austin. I found that on the internet. That's from the University of Texas, where they mention their some of their founding professors. And so he's at the final stage of his life, and he organized a theological seminary of Austin and continued to write in the fields of sociology, politics, philosophy, and economics. And what's striking to me is Dabney lived to be 1898 and became blind in 1889. If you do the math, that's 9 years of his life where he's doing all his writing and teaching while totally blind. I haven't been able to figure out how he was able to do it, but it's so interesting. You see the picture of that they represent of these people leading Dabney to the podium, and this man is totally blind. And remember, to the people that respected Dabney in his lifetime, he was bigger than life. I mean, they knew about his abilities as a theologian before he even went to Texas, which enabled him to make friends very quickly. And a lot of people thought he was probably not easy to get along with, which wasn't at all the case. And I remember reading a story of he's walking in between classes, and a young lady comes up to him, and she's in tears, and she's talking about the problems that she's having, and that she needs counsel as to whether or not she should marry the young man. And Dabney's listening, and he's ascertaining this, and he gives her such excellent counsel that she walks away with her heart completely lifted. He was eminently approachable. He was a very kind man to his neighbors. In fact, he gave away a lot. I thought it was remarkable, even in the introduction to Lucas's biography, that he had given a former black slave a house and 10 acres of land. Just gave it to her. His eulogies are very interesting. Dabney was a man of intense feeling. Like John the Apostle, he was by nature a Boanerges. Some who did not know him well might call him stern or severe. True, he had a Pauline hatred of falsehood and injustice, but he would not have been more human if his indignation had never overflowed when he saw his beloved South in Reconstruction days oppressed by unscrupulous political adventurers. Is it not beautiful to see the power of divine grace refining and ennobling a strong character, just as the mellow light of the evening sun softens and beautifies the outline of a towering granite peak? Especially was this true as blindness came upon him. His close friends said it was moving to note his growth in Christ-likeness, in patience, in thoughtful kindness, and in cheerfully bowing to the Father's will. He was a matchless teacher. He possessed a clear, powerful intellect which grasped the substance of the most profound philosophical themes and made them plain. He had that close contact with men, that practical experience of affairs which enabled him to present difficult subjects in their relation to the thought and needs of everyday life. If you're wondering, what would it be like to be a student of a teacher like Dabney? He was tough. I mean, back then it was assumed that you knew Latin even before you took studies in systematics. And he required a lot of his students, and he would write his questions out a couple of days in advance for the next lesson and let them study it out. But the students really respected him. He exemplified the difference between a learned bookworm who knew his subject only from a theoretical viewpoint and a profound master who presented it in relation to the actual experience of his hearers. Dabney had that rare gift of making systematic theology not a study of dry bones, but a living system. Most interesting and instructive because throbbing with reality and power. William Shedd, a theologian in those days, said of him that he was an acute and learned scholar, and that in his judgment, Dabney was the greatest living theologian. And I know that Archibald Alexander Hodge, A.A. Hodge, also had the same estimate of Dabney. I remember that so well because in the introduction to the volumes on discussions when those came out, those were the good old days at Trinity when I could get the three volumes of the Banner of Truth discussions for $21.95. And I say this to my shame, Fred Huebner ran Trinity Book Service, and I said, well, $21.95 for three, how much do you want for one? He says, well, I'm selling them, all three of them as a set, and I got him to sell me one at a time. But in the blurb, it said that Archibald Alexander said that Hodge was the greatest living theologian. So I wrote to the Banner of Truth, and I said, I think Dabney was only about 30 years old when Archibald Alexander died. I said, don't you mean A.A. Hodge? And they wrote back, and they said, yes, we're going to correct that in the later editions of his discussions. I think I have a couple of minutes for questions, whether or not I have answers. I wanted to say one more thing about his discussions and the systematic theology and so on. They're now available on CD-ROM through Ages software. You've seen those Ages CD. They have the works of Gill, the works of Pink, the works of Spurgeon, the works of B.H. Carroll, who I showed you his picture earlier and so on. When I discovered that they were publishing the works of Dabney, I kept on them until they had it completed. They had published his systematic theology, and I wanted to have his discussions on CD-ROM, and I wanted them to be searchable. And it took a while for them to get it done, so by the time that they published his works on the CD-ROM, because of my patience with them, they actually gave me a free CD of whatever one that I wanted to choose. Those people are they're very kind and good Christian brethren. Go ahead, Pastor Chansky. Is there anything that you know on that?
No, I think you summarized it well. Also, Tom, anything relevant regarding Dabney's writings and what we're seeing happening politically today? I'm thinking of the role of government in the economy.
All right, I'm glad you brought this up, and I think this is it's really an important point, though it almost merits a whole nother discussion as Dabney's view of the economy. But there's a book out by C. Greg Singer called The Theological Interpretations of American History. And this book is superb, but it takes what Dabney had started and it traces our history of the United States from the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and show how there was a different mindset that went into the Declaration of Independence that went into the Constitution. And Singer traces this out through history and so on, and it's very good supplemental material to the things that Dabney tried to show. Dabney had a vision prophetically in the sense that he could look at the scriptures and he could see where these institutions were going, our public education, these labor unions, the out-of-control capitalism of the North, and so on. But maybe he didn't see it as far as we see it. And in C. Greg Singer's book, which was published in 1964, there's a chapter in there, for example, on the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt. And you start reading the things that they tried to espouse in those days. It is right along the lines of our present liberal political bent. And it's amazing how these men even began to see this at the end of the Civil War and the ramifications of this. Obviously, it's too lengthy to go into it, but sometime it might be worth discussing just, you know, where are these things leading us and how can they be interpreted theologically? Because Dabney believed that you cannot look at them and interpret them unless you interpret them in light of the Bible. And he does a pretty tremendous job of that. And with that, I better close. Father, I'm completely aware of my insufficiency to stand and bring light to such a man as Dabney. I'm aware of my own infirmities and so on. And yet I hope that something I said would bring light to others who haven't really studied out this period. Maybe they haven't studied out what is Reconstruction, what was the antebellum South, and what are the political theories behind the direction in which our country is presently going. And I say, as George Gillespie, when he was sitting there with the Westminster Divines, the man that could argue so well, but I say with him, more light, Lord, more light on thy cause. We ask in Jesus' name, amen.